From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Charles Taylor, a distinguished philosopher, author, and emeritus professor of philosophy at McGill University in Montreal. He recently received the 6th Kluge Prize for Achievement in the Study of Humanity, awarded by the U.S. Library of Congress. The Library of Congress is the nation's oldest federal cultural institution and serves as the research arm of Congress. It is also the largest library in the world, with millions of books, recordings, photographs, maps, and manuscripts in its collections. And we're coming to you from the Library of Congress here in Washington, D.C. Charles Taylor is considered one of the most prominent and influential philosophers on the world stage today. He is best known for his contributions to political philosophy, the philosophy of social science, and the history of philosophy and intellectual history. His writings have been published in 20 languages, and they are known for linking seemingly disparate disciplines, from reflections on artificial intelligence to analyses of multicultural societies, to the study of religion and what it means to live in a secular age. Charles Taylor's work on secular and spiritual dimensions in his book entitled A Secular Age earned him the Templeton Prize in 2007. And Charles Taylor joins us here at the Library of Congress. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations on your Kluge Prize.
Thank you.
Well, Charles Taylor, I'd like to get your reaction to having won this prize, what it means to you.
Well, the recognition is so moving and so important to me. I don't really know if I fully deserve it, but it's wonderful to have your work echoed in this way and other people saying, yes, it's been useful, it's been something that has helped me. Whenever I get that reaction, I'm tremendously encouraged, and in this case, in spades.
Well, we'll talk about your work throughout the interview, but first I'd like to get to the point that you were said to be a devout Catholic. And, of course, we witnessed the historic visit of Pope Francis in the United States recently. I'd like to get your view of Pope Francis and his impact on not just Catholics around the world, but many other people of other faiths. Is he a transformative person, Pope, in your view?
It looks that way. I mean, I feel that way about him, and I feel he's done wonderful work bringing, I think, the central point of Christianity and the gospel to the world as a whole, and speaking not just to Catholics, but speaking to, we're now dealing with an audience in a globalized world, which is people of all points of view. And I think that's been quite a remarkable event, as it were, his election and his interventions.
He's outspoken about climate change and other issues that face the world here in the United States, immigration reform. To what extent do you think he can make a lasting impact on these debates?
Well, I think he can because, I mean, maybe people are not going to be converted immediately from, let's say, a very negative view about what we have to do about climate change to a sense of responsibility. But this kind of, for instance, take his encyclical on the climate change, it's a tremendous encouragement to people who have been thinking and worrying and sometimes working and hoping that we would actually get on top of this problem, which we are not. And these people will go to work with redoubled effort and energy and encouragement because of his support and his advocacy. So I think this is something that can be immensely positive in its consequences.
In your book, A Secular Age, you argue against the so-called secularization thesis that posits that as modernity progresses, religion gradually becomes less influential in our lives. How do you define secularism? How do you reconcile religion and secularism?
Well, I think secularism is different from secularization. Secularism, it's a principle whereby states are no longer, as it were, colored by a certain religion or aligned with a certain religion or non-religion against others. And I think that's a very important positive development in the modern world, which you in America pioneered in a certain sense with the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. You know, Congress shall establish no church. But secularization is a much more complicated thing. The point of my book is that it isn't the same everywhere is something very different. It's very analogous but very different process in China or in India or in Africa or in America or in Europe. In some cases, it has led to a decline in religious faith and practice, notably in certain countries of Western Europe. In other cases, not at all, like in the United States and so on. So, in a certain sense, what is in common between all these different forms of secularization is a new pluralism in religion, a new recognition of the fact that people are spiritual seekers, that many of them are trying to find their way, find the spirituality that really suits them. And that recognition of plurality is a very fundamental feature of all these different secularizations.
So for you, there is a role for religion or some sort of spirituality.
Yes, there will always be. I mean, people will always disagree on this, and there'll be some people who reject all the existing forms of religion and have a new philosophy. And more we're going to see diversity in this particular regard. But I find it very, very unlikely that the spiritual or religious options will suddenly disappear or dry up. They're constantly being renewed. That's another interesting feature of this age. They're constantly being renewed. We spoke about Pope Francis. I mean, this is a new take on Catholicism and so on for a lot of people, which is erupting onto the scene in our age. So these spiritual traditions are constantly changing, developing, and so on.
In contrast, too, though, we're also witnessing forms of extremism, religious extremism in the world, which have been leading to violence, again, whether it's Islamist extremists or fundamentalist Christians or Jews. We're seeing some groups use religion for their violent ends. Again, not saying religion is necessarily promoting this, but does that worry you that religion is being distorted for political or violent ends?
Oh, deeply, deeply. I mean, it's not the only ideology that has been the basis of violence. I mean, there have been various kinds of nationalism. You know, we saw with the Nazis, there are various kinds of totally secular outlooks like communism, which have been the source of great violence. But you find people in all these different religious groups proposing a certain version of their faith, which actually is the inspiration to them for violence. But in almost all these cases, I mean, in the case of Islam, very clear, it's a kind of terrible distortion of what anyone can see as the basic thrust of the message. I mean, every surah of the Quran, except one, I think, starts in the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate. How that can in any way square with the operations of Islamic State forces, you know, it just beggars the imagination. So there's a terrible distortion here. The same kind of distortion that you had of German nationalists under the Nazis recruiting people like Goethe and Kant as the basis of this horrifying Nazi regime. So we have to be clear in our minds that there are this temptation to distort, and we mustn't target any particular view as being something that it by itself generates this kind of violent action.
We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
We're back with our special guest, Charles Taylor. He's a distinguished philosopher and author and emeritus professor of philosophy at McGill University. He was recently awarded the John W. Kluge Prize for Achievement in the Study of Humanity by the Library of Congress. Well, back to you, Charles Taylor, to talk a bit about what's going on here in the United States with the presidential campaign, but also reflect back on the stewardship of President Barack Obama, whose term is coming to an end. You know, he was very noted for using diplomacy or trying to use less force and more diplomacy in resolving foreign policy issues. Some say he has bent over backwards to some extent a bit reflexively to do the opposite of George W. Bush, who arguably used force perhaps too much. again, I'd like to get your reflections on his stewardship, his leadership on the world stage.
From the standpoint of where I come from, which is outside the United States, which is Canada, I think it's an immense improvement because there's something deeply realistic about his attitude, which unfortunately didn't exist with George Bush and doesn't exist with some of his critics. The United States can't lead the world alone. It can't enforce its will alone. The United States is a possible immense source of good, of liberal values, of tolerance, and so on, has played a tremendous role in the 20th century, but always with allies, right? And the Second World War is an example. And it can do the same again with allies. So it's becoming a team player, being able to listen and persuade, which is the maximum condition of the U.S. doing some really important good in the world. As soon as the United States believes that it doesn't need allies, it doesn't need to listen to people, it needs just to bully people and tell them what to do, then its efficacy falls off very, very rapidly. So we may argue, quibble about this or that decision by Barack Obama, but he really understands that. And it's marvelous and refreshing from the outside point of view to see an American leader that does understand that.
Well, Charles Taylor, it may be marvelous and refreshing, but some critics would say that he perhaps went too far in the other direction, that he is retreating America from the world stage as we look in the Middle East, whether the terrible crisis in Syria. He did a noble thing in Libya by saving people in the eastern part of the country in Benghazi, but at the same time, critics say he didn't finish the job because after having liberated those in Benghazi, which then led to the death of Muammar Gaddafi, now we have arms flowing throughout northern Africa. Mm-hmm. So again, what about those who say he broadcast too publicly what he will not do, and in that regard, he's sort of showing his hand, no boots on the ground. Okay, that's fine if you really don't want to put boots on the ground. Nobody was asking for them anyway. But why broadcast that to your so-called adversaries? What about the style of leadership?
Oh, but you see, you're broadcasting it also to the people that should be taking the primary responsibility. The problem is, in various parts of the world, that some of the allies or possible allies have got used to just relying on the United States. As a matter of fact, it's true of the rest of us in NATO, perhaps, that we haven't anteed up as much military force as we ought to, considering our capacity and our population and so on. It's certainly true of Europe. And that, again, comes back to the central point, that the United States can't do this alone, and it's no use trying to pretend to potential allies that it can. And in this case, the Middle East, the Middle Eastern societies, which have partly created this problem of Islamic State by extremely narrow version of Sunni Islam, which has provoked the reaction against that, partly created this problem by not recognizing that it has a military task here, partly because there's been certain amount of support leaking out to Islamic State from Saudi Arabia and other such societies, right? So they need to be confronted with their responsibility, not just because, you know, they need to be confronted with the responsibility, but because unless they intervene, there's no possible solution to this.
Unless they
intervene, there's no possible solution. I mean, it's absurd to think that the United States could use its armed force. That was a mistake of Iraq, right? The Iraq intervention. The United States could use its armed force itself to transform this area into something that can live with itself. So it's, I think, extremely important to broadcast to potential allies that there's no way forward if the United States put boots on the ground, lets them off the hook, and then what happens? They go away, and what happens when they go away, right? We saw that with the intervention in Iraq. I listened to people on the other side, the Republican candidates, the Republican nomination. I think they're dreaming in colors. Perhaps it was a mistake altogether to go into Libya, but what would finishing the job mean?
Cleaning up the arms, not, again, you know, helping to remove the arms from these various militias.
Yeah, but just a minute. I mean, how do they do that? It would mean boots on the ground.
Maybe Europeans?
Yeah, maybe European boots. But, you know, see, it's much more complicated. And the Syrian situation is so tremendously complicated. I hear people saying, oh, it's very simple. We just, you know, intervene. What are they thinking of? Why don't, I would like to ask them, give us a plan instead of just saying, he's too weak. We've got to go in there.
Indeed. Well, we'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Charles Taylor, distinguished philosopher, author, and emeritus professor of philosophy at McGill University in Montreal. He recently was awarded the John W. Kluge Prize for Achievement in the Study of Humanity by the Library of Congress. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can also send feedback via email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Either way, tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout out to a valued loyal listener of PCUSA and Encounter, Chibundu Uchebu from Oweri, Imo State in Nigeria. Well, back to you, Charles Taylor. To continue our discussion about politics, the U.S. role in the world. We're coming up on a presidential election. I'm sure you've been watching the debates,
yes.
Particularly by the Republicans, who are obviously chomping at the bit, as we say, to get into the White House. Any thoughts about the GOP lineup? Do you see any potential presidential material there? What are your thoughts?
I'm very distressed, not to say depressed, to listen to that lineup, because there seem to be a number of dogmas that they share. I'm not sure they really do, but you somehow have to pretend you share them to be in that race, and I think that they're disastrous. I mean, number one, there doesn't seem to be anybody who takes climate change seriously, and I think it's just obvious that that is the biggest challenge the human race has ever faced, and that we are failing to rise to it. And we urgently need to get our act together. And we have a chance, of course, in November, December in Paris. And we may miss that chance. And it's partly because there is this tremendous resistance among U.S. Republicans, it seems, to face the obvious facts. And then the second thing that worries me that doesn't seem to be discussed among them as a matter of debate is what we just talked about earlier, that America must intervene, must stand strong, must stand tall. And no one seems to have worked out what the complexities of this involve. So it's terrifying for the outside world to think that one of these people could actually be president of the most powerful country and do incalculable damage to the things we all hold dear. In the Western Alliance, for instance, all hold very dear. So this is very worrying. I mean, perhaps a lot of these people don't really believe it inside, but they have to say that. But it's kind of worrying that they have to say that.
Indeed, when one is campaigning, the rhetoric is somewhat different, but nonetheless.
And they're not preparing their public for the kinds of decisions that the U.S. government will have to take in regard to foreign policy or in regard to global warming, see, that will be forced to take. I think the rest of the world won't accept that America stand aside. Even China has jumped ahead of the U.S. in taking very important measures to cope with the issue of climate change. And so the world is not going to stand idly by if America sabotages our last best chance of dealing with this crucial issue.
Well, let's move now to a different type of actor on the world stage, Vladimir Putin. Many people are saying, even in our own U.S. military, that he does represent a major threat, perhaps one of the most serious threats, as serious even as the so-called Islamic State and other violent extremist movements. We witnessed Putin upend the post-World War II order by invading Ukraine, by taking Crimea, notwithstanding its history intertwined with Russia, that is, the country of Ukraine. Nonetheless, this was a sovereign country. What are your thoughts with respect to Vladimir Putin, his actions, and how, whether it's Europe or the United States, is dealing with him?
Yeah. No, I think he's a tremendous threat to his immediate environment. You see, I don't think he's a threat beyond that, but unfortunately, Ukraine is part of the immediate environment. I think you have here a post-imperial society. We've seen some of those in the West, you know, France and Britain and so on had great trouble divesting themselves of their empires, a post-imperial society that just cannot accept the new situation. So I think that for Putin, and how much this is him himself and how much this is handy appeal to a certain residual Russian nationalism, but whatever, just cannot accept that the breakup of the Soviet Union is a breakup of what could be independent states that have to be dealt with like adults and states with their own interests and own will. And you could work it out if you discussed with them. But the country wants them still to be more or less what we used to say in the 19th century in the sphere of influence, right, of greater Russia. And the problem is the degree of ruthlessness and disregard for the rules that with which he's carried us out is really, really threatening. And so that has to be faced as Europe and America are trying to do in the case of the Ukraine. But I don't think he's a world threat in the way that the Soviet Union was. I think you have this tremendous nostalgia for empire. You know, there was a Russian Empire, and the Soviet Union was a kind of remake of the Russian Empire, right?
Exactly.
And now he wants a remake of the Soviet Union, and you just cannot have that in the 21st century.
Turning now to another theme that you write about, and that is multicultural societies. I'd love to get your reflection on multiculturalism. It's an important concept. It exists now. We're all multicultural societies, one could say, and now, with the flow of migrants and refugees coming out of conflict-ridden areas, whether from Syria or Afghanistan, whether Europe or the United States are going to be taking in more, and as a result, their societies will become even more multicultural.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see this as a positive? Do you see some potential setbacks as a result?
Oh, I think it's a tremendously positive development. But first of all, it's a factual development that we're becoming more diverse. I mean, particularly our rich democracies in the West, including Australia, so we're not quite a geographic concept. And it's becoming diverse for two reasons. We have to remember, partly because of migration, but partly also because the whole culture is one in which people are more and more invited to explore their beliefs, explore their spiritual path, and therefore diversity is arising, you know, within these societies. Partly because existing differences of identity have been ignored in the past, have not been given their place. We think of the feminist movement and putting that on the agenda. So for all these reasons, as a matter of fact, we are much more diverse and we're going to become even more diverse. So we have to find a way of saving our very fundamental democratic values in the course of this, which involve non-discrimination, equality, and human rights. And we have to work out new ways of having a really non-discriminatory mode of existence, of ensuring the equality of all citizens, inclusiveness of all citizens. So you get multiculturalism can be seen from another point of view as a series of policies that people try to explore in order to make this kind of equality come about. But it starts off, as you say, from a basic fact, and it's that fact is a challenge to go on sustaining our democratic values of inclusiveness.
But what about the concept of identity? We contrast, for example, the way the United Kingdom, Britain, integrates immigrants into the country with, for example, France and the United States. Which model do you think should be emulated?
There isn't a single model because situations are so different, but there are certain, I think, terrible errors to be avoided. And the basic nature of the errors to be avoided is stigmatization of a new group of immigrants and the consequent discrimination against them in all sorts of ways, which create a sense among them that, well, we're not accepted here, we're not allowed here, and so on, and consequently, an, if you like, identity backlash, where they feel that in order to assert themselves, they have to be against the society in which they're living. A classical example of that going on today is France, which has taken a very worrying turn since 2000. More and more discriminatory legislation, stigmatization of Muslims, creating kind of backlash in a situation in which that kind of backlash was always a threat. I'll tell you why. Because the Muslim immigrants of France are, for the most part, of Algerian origin. And there's been a terrible history in the last 200 years between France and Algeria, a history of colonial domination, conquest, and a battle for independence, and so on, right? And this has created on both sides potentially hard feelings, prejudices, and so on. You would have thought that the French Republic would have gone out of its way to heal these wounds, and instead they have deepened them. And so it's this kind of creation of alienation, which is something you have to avoid. If you do, there is a lot going for really happy and successful integration. When we had a commission on these issues in Quebec, we asked people, why are you coming to Quebec? And they had two reasons. One was freedom, and the second was, I can give my children a chance in life I could never have given them in wherever the country of origin was. Now, if there's any hope of that, if they feel they're not being shut out, discriminated against, there's an immensely positive sense of what it is to live in this society, right? You see this in the United States all the time. People will say, wonderful, I came to America, and now I really have a chance to give my kids an education and thank America, right? It's that reaction which we can, you know, almost count on in cases where migrating actually works for these people. So it's not as though you have to force them to like America, or you have to force them to like France if it works for them, or you have to force them to like Canada. No, they will, unless you really go out of your way to push them aside.
Well, we're seeing a bit of that attitude in the debate here in the United States over immigration, particularly with one particular candidate, Donald Trump, which is, of course, is rather worrying.
Very worrying. And there's another candidate that says that Muslims can't square their faith with the U.S. Constitution. Where did this come from? I mean, we owe America this magnificent principle from the very beginning of religious non-discrimination and so on. And now somebody's running for the U.S. presidency and negating this is really, really, really worrying. But I'm hoping that that kind of thing will be really rejected by the whole process and in the end will be resoundingly defeated, whether at the level of who's candidate or at the level of who's president.
As we close, Charles Taylor, speaking of immigration, migration trends, and post-World War II history, we are witnessing with the flow of migrants from the Middle East the largest wave of immigration or migration since World War II. How do you think Europe in particular, because Germany is at the forefront, and one could say ironically in a very positive sense, agreeing to take in so many migrants, refugees, depending on their category, especially given their history, that this is a welcome and very positive stance. What are your thoughts with regard to how these people should be vetted and either integrated or not? Particularly in Europe. And what about the role of the United States? Since one could argue but that both Europe and the United States, to some extent, helped to create this crisis by either indifference or inaction with respect to the conflicts in the Middle East.
Yeah, but even if we didn't, you know, I'm talking about Canada as well, we owe it to these people to share the burden that Europe is now bearing. And I think both Canada and the United States should open their hearts and open their doors to a much greater degree than at present. I mean, I know that there's been a good announcement of 100,000, I think, on the part of the president, but there's a lot of resistance to that in other parts of the American political system.
And others would say that's paltry.
Yeah.
A paltry number.
I think that is a better judgment. Our government has said 10,000, they finally came around to that, which is exactly proportionate. The U.S. population is about 10 times Canada, but I think that's also really paltry. So I think we owe it to ourselves, our tradition, what we are as human beings, to respond in a much more open way to that.
As we close, I'd like to get your thoughts about how you will spend or use the award money that comes with the Kluge Prize for Humanity, but other books or articles you're working on.
I haven't, it's all too much for me. I haven't got over it, but there's a number of different causes that I really want to be able to dedicate myself to. But I also want to go on and write a couple more books that need to be developed. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Any topics in particular you want to share
with
us?
Yes, I'm just publishing a book on the nature of human language. And I want to go on to talk about the consequences of that understanding of human language to understand modern poetics.
Charles Taylor is a distinguished philosopher, author, and he's emeritus professor of philosophy at McGill University. He is the recipient of this year's Kluge Prize for Achievement in the Study of Humanity, awarded by the U.S. Library of Congress. Well, Professor Taylor, congratulations once again on receiving this award. Thank you so much for your time and wonderful insights.
Thank you very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Ted Schneider. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.